Welcome to episode 52 of the Payers and Players podcast. Please follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Our handle is Payers Players, and you can reach us at payersandplayers@gmail.com. Also, check out our website, www.payersandplayers.com, for the latest show notes and an extensive video library of today's top and rising stars. Today's guest is Jack Newman, the founder of the Austin Tennis Academy.
So Jack Newman, welcome to the show. We're happy to have you on.
Great to be here.
Great. So I was wondering if you could give us a little bit of background about the Austin Tennis Academy, sort of how it got founded, when you founded it, and sort of what was your motivation to found the academy?
Sure. So the Austin Tennis Academy was founded in 2003. A group of coaches had been working together at St. Stephen's School in Austin at a program that Eric Schmidhauser and I founded in the middle 1990s. And we got caught in the crossfire of a headmaster being fired and the program being kind of squished down into a much smaller size. So we decided that, certainly the right of the school to have whatever program they want to have, but it wasn't what we were interested in doing. So we rented courts at a local country club for a year and managed to put together a business plan to build a facility and run a program that was similar to what we were doing at St. Stephen's, but slightly different. We did not have our own school to start out with. So that was in 2003, and the Austin Tennis Academy grew for the next 5 years pretty geometrically. And during that time, we found the need to have our own school. Some of our students were wanting to seek out higher levels of competition, and that meant traveling a bit more and missing a bit of school, and neither the public nor the private schools in our area were very excited about that prospect. So Josh Hager was one of our students who was really excited about pursuing excellence, and his mom was the head of the homeschool co-op in Austin, and Carol became the head of our school and has kind of guided that process from I call it a homeschool on steroids to start out with, to a fully accredited private school with 35 students. So that's kind of evolved over the course of the since 2003. So that's kind of the thumbnail sketch of the founding of the Austin Tennis Academy.
Awesome. Great. So, and tell us a little bit about the setup you have there in terms of your courts, the surfaces, what kind of, extra outside, like say a gymnasium or things like that. Can you give us a picture of what the academy looks
sure.
like?
Yep. We've got 12 outdoor hard courts. One row of six, and then three banks of two courts each. And then we've got two red clay courts. We've got a fitness center that's got about 3,600 square feet of exercise equipment. And then we've got about 3,000 square feet of classroom space.
Nice. And, on your website, you had something I thought was really neat, your mission statement. And part of your mission statement was, it says living the sport. And I think that's great because there are so many lessons that tennis offers, but a lot of academies really just focus on how many balls you're hitting, but not, all the stuff around the sport. So could you talk a little bit about, what that mission statement is and how you guys fulfill that with your students?
Sure. I think, we have the same sort of goals that other people have and the same sort of philosophy that other people have, using tennis as kind of the tool to help mold kids into better human beings. And I think that being involved in a sport is really great for kids, and tennis is, I think, a uniquely great sport in that, no timeouts, no substitutions, one-on-one, mostly self-officiated. All of that offers many, many opportunities for young people to make decisions. And of course, they make good decisions and sometimes they make bad decisions. And all of that is a learning process. But if you're in it over time, and one of the things that I'm most proud of is that the majority of the students in our program start hitting their first ball at ATA when they're 7 or 8 years old and end up graduating and going on to college. So I think that using tennis as a tool to shape people and have them learn life lessons and learn skills that will serve them as adults is part of our philosophy. And I think that, you know, leveraging college choice is another part of our philosophy. And being a good member of your community is another part of our philosophy.
Yeah, so while we were there for Little Mo, one of the things I noticed was the banners along the fences, right? There were a lot of kids that went through ATA and have had signed with colleges or had collegiate success. Can you kind of talk about a few of those kids that have come through your program and had some success in college?
Sure. Well, first of all, I think we like celebrating success. And every student who graduates from the Austin Tennis Academy who goes on to play college tennis, whether it's at D1, 2, or 3, gets a banner. And on that banner is, you know, where they're going to college. If they participated in USTA tournaments and won a silver, gold, or bronze ball, that gets recognized. If they won a state high school championship, that gets recognized. We also have banners for ranking accomplishments, so top 50 in the nation. We have a banner for that. And we also have lots of banners for junior team tennis. ATA is a big supporter of junior team tennis. And if we win a national championship, all the kids' names get put up on a banner and hung at the facility. We also take a picture of each senior in their college shirt hitting a ball and have that blown up and framed and hang that in the fitness center so every player who's graduated can look back and see their picture hanging in the fitness center at ATA. So as far as kind of going backwards in time to some of the students that have come through the Austin Tennis Academy, actually one of our current coaches, Brandon Davis, was one of our first students. He's the son of Coach Doug Davis. He and his brother Blake both played high level Division I college tennis. Brandon at the University of Illinois, and he was on the team that lost in the national finals when Kevin Anderson was on their team. And then Blake Davis played for FSU at a high level as well. Kind of moving forward in time, some of the kids that kind of stand out, and I apologize in advance for those that I forget, so that I don't have a list in front of me, but Jeffrey Offerdahl played at Vanderbilt University and did a great job for them. Josh Hager played more recently at Notre Dame University, was the captain of the team there. We've got a number of kids playing right now. Peyton Holden at Princeton University, he's the captain of his team there. And Abigail Chu is playing at Dartmouth. She's into her second year there. We've sent five kids, one kid every year for the last 5 years to the University of Chicago. We've sent kids to all the NESCAC schools, Amherst, Williams, Middlebury, Wesleyan, the other top D3, Claremont McKenna and Emory and places like that, Wash U. So, you know, we send kids to a variety of places. Mostly we're trying to leverage their college choice through the combination of their academics and their tennis. And, you know, obviously some kids are more accomplished as tennis players. Some kids are more accomplished in the classroom, and whatever that combination is, we try to find a good fit for them in college so that they can have a great experience playing college tennis and being part of a team.
Well, yeah, that's a really impressive list of colleges from an academic standpoint and tennis standpoint, because those all have both very strong academics and also good tennis teams. So that's a perfect mix of what you're trying to accomplish. So I think, you know, the way that you focus on both the academic and the tennis side, like you say, is, you know, it shows in the results that you're seeing. So that's impressive. But could you tell us also about, you know, sort of the various programs you have? Because is it just for those 35 kids that are in the school there, or is it open to different programs for kids that might come after school or before school, or what kind of a variety do you have there?
Sure. So if we start at our youngest age group, we have a group which we call junior development, which is kids between the ages of 5 and probably 11 or 12 is the oldest in that group. And those are kids who are just starting out. So could be their first time coming to tennis, could be kids that have been in our program for a number of years who have, you know, kind of continued through that program. Those kids come twice a week for an hour and a half. And then the next level up from them is something we call Junior Academy. And those kids come 3 days a week for an hour and a half. And they're typically between the ages of 9 and 13. And then we have a 12 and under Academy program, which is for kids, maybe like kids who play Little Mo Nationals, younger kids who are really accomplished and driven to be good. Then we have a 4-day Academy program in the afternoon after school. And then we have ATA College Prep, which those kids practice in the morning before school, and then they have the same afternoon practice as the kids who are in the other schools in the Austin area that come to ATA. So that's kind of the gamut of programs that we offer. And all of those kids are encouraged to play junior team tennis, and all of them are encouraged to play tournaments. We do a lot of, we send a lot of coaches to team tennis matches, and we send a lot of coaches to tournaments.
Very good. You know, one of the things I notice for high-level players is they have shied away from high school tennis. You know, and high school tennis can be a varying level of competition. What's your kind of your philosophy on your players who are at the highest level competing in high school tennis?
Yeah, we've had kind of a mixed level of success with that. Many of our students play high school tennis. Obviously, if they're at ATA College Prep, they're not playing for another school because they're already in a school. But Lake Travis High School and Westlake High School are two schools that a lot of our students attend. And we've had a number of our students win state championships playing for high school teams. I know the Lake Travis team has gotten closer and closer to winning a team state championship. They haven't done so yet, but they've been in the Final Four a few times, and I would say a good number of players who have participated on those teams have developed in our program.
Is ATA allowed to compete in high school tennis?
We typically have not, although we are playing in an invitational tournament in February of 2020 for the first time. Typically, because the level of the students that are in our school is fairly high, most are either high school or national level players. We probably would not be welcome, is the best way to put it.
But a little bit of a ringer effect, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But this invitational tournament that we're going to is actually a national tournament where teams are coming from all over the country.
Is that the DecoTurf tournament in I think Chattanooga?
No, this one's in Waco actually.
Okay.
It's a new one on the schedule.
Okay.
But
yeah, our local high school competes in a sort of a high level national high school tournament. But as I'm thinking about it, it's in March, but it's in Chattanooga. So it's obviously a different event.
Yeah, and DecoTurf, what you're referring to, Scott, is called DecoTurf, and it's a super high level high school tennis event that's very very good.
Yeah.
Right. So whoever's running the event reached out to us, and we're happy to come and fill a spot and compete hard and see how we do.
Well, it's always fun. It's always more fun to compete as a team. So I'm sure that would be a great event for your kids. And about your school, how early can you be in the ATA school? I'm sorry, what's the name of the school? Is it ATA or is it something different?
It's ATA College Prep.
Okay.
And
when does it start? Yeah.
K kids can, we have a elementary portion, a middle school portion, and a high school portion. So kids can start usually around fifth or sixth grade. But they've got to be super passionate about tennis and super engaged in being a tennis player to have it be a good fit.
Right. And what is the role of the parent at ATA? How involved are the parents with the school, with the tennis? And to talk about sort of how you view sort of an ideal tennis parent for your students.
Sure. So I think that there's a wide gamut of parent participation in the tennis development process at ATA. There are some parents who are very, very involved, and they're meeting with coaches probably on the phone or in person on a weekly basis about what's happening and as far as the child's development and tournament schedule. And I would say that's probably more the case the younger the player is. You know, once players get to that 14, 15, 16, 17 age, two things happen. One, I think if they've been in our program for 4 to 5 years, we've developed a level of trust with the parents that they're probably more apt to let the coach be the developmental leader rather than the parent. And I think also if they have other children, you know, as you both know, having been this process, it becomes a pretty involved deal when you start having to travel the national tournaments and, you know, trying to reach that level or above. So I would say, we welcome parent involvement. We welcome parents being a big part of the process. We understand as coaches that part of our job is to educate parents as well as our students on, you know, being a tennis player, being a tennis parent, how the developmental process works, how the competitive process works. We do a number of group parent meetings a year, 2 to 3 or 4, where we're helping parents understand our program, helping parents understand the system, bringing in some experts. We have a guy, David Benzel, that we really like, that's come in and give some presentations to our parents. So I think that we're very parent friendly. I think that we're also been doing what we've been doing for a good amount of years. You know, Coach Doug Davis and I are both 30 plus years as junior developers. We've got younger coaches who are, you know, 15 to 20 years, and then we've got some younger coaches than that who are 10 years or a little bit less. So we've been in the process for quite a long time, and we have a system that we like to use. We have a methodology that we like to use. And one of the things that I would say is that there are many, many ways to pursue excellence. And being part of a community and being part of a group is one of those ways. And that's the way ATA operates. We operate as a team. We operate as a group. We operate as a community. And if you're much more individualistic in the way that you want to approach things, our program may not be the best fit. And that's not to say that you can't develop a great tennis athlete individually. You certainly can. It's been done hundreds of times, thousands of times. But it's not how we do it. We do it in a little different way. We like to have the group. We like to have the kids travel as a team. We like to, have it be a very team-oriented. You know, tennis is a very hard and lonely sport for kids. And so we try to make it as team-like as we possibly can. And we feel like that's a very healthy thing for kids and, frankly, very healthy thing for parents as well. So I'd say we're very parent-friendly, but we're also kind of team-oriented. So if you're very individualistic, you're going to control all the variables yourself. ATA is probably not a good fit. But other than that, I'd say we're extremely parent-friendly.
So tell me this, as for a lot of kids, HBO just ran a good special this past week, if you've not seen it, with a guy from Atlanta named Neeru Jayanthi, and he's been on some other podcasts like the Parenting Aces. But he talks a lot about sports where kids play only one sport, and how it can open them up to injuries. And what I've noticed is in the tennis community, often the best players have parents who are very driven, right? And they drive their child to be very driven as well. And that can often lead to injuries that are unnecessary because they, for a, say a 9-year-old who's training like a pro tennis player, their body just can't handle it. So what are some of the things you do outside of tennis, say in injury prevention or strength training or whatever, that because the reality is, as a coach, you probably want the parents to almost turn their child over to the coach. And many parents probably are okay with that. But they also have to trust that the coach understands how to prevent injury and do the fitness portion. Yep. So what are some things y'all do at ATA that can kind of prepare the player in that fashion?
Yep. Well, I'd say the first thing is, if a parent wants to individually train a child, we need to do a good job of educating them about the volume and intensity of training that's appropriate by age group, by size, by physical development. So that's part of our job, is to help educate people so that we don't have people getting injured. Part of our program is a fitness component. So our younger kids, the kids that come in the junior development and the JD program and the JA program, Junior Academy, of their hour and a half, two or three times a week, 30 minutes of that is athletic skills. And you can substitute fitness for athletic skills interchangeably. What we've found over the last 10 to 15 years is that there's a lot less PE time in the public schools, especially. And so our students maybe are lacking some of the basic run, throw, track skills that we might have gotten as children, kind of just playing outside on our own. So we have incorporated that into our younger kid program, where athletic skills are part of the program. As they move up in the level of the program, the level of their tennis competitions, we add more in. So the typical academy student, if they come 4 days a week in the afternoon, the first 30 minutes of every practice is fitness. And we have a couple of really great guys, Josh Rifkin and Dio Miranda, who run our strength and conditioning program. And they have got a curriculum laid out for the whole year that kids go through. And they do 30 minutes every day before they practice. And then there's a lot of recovery and rainy days for us, our fitness days and mental toughness days. So if we have 300 days of training a year and 50 of those are raining, we add an extra hour of fitness and mental training on those rainy days. So, for example, today we had a pretty wet day in Austin. Our college prep students, they have a 2-hour morning practice. They had a fitness session that lasted 2 hours, which included a lot of stretching and rolling out in addition to whatever the fitness guys were working on today. And then in the afternoon, the kids that come just in the afternoon, they'd have a 30-minute session with those same guys. So if you're in the 12-hour a week afternoon program, of those 12 hours, two of those are fitness alone. And then if kids need extra help, all of our fitness guys are available for 30 or 60 minute private sessions. Some of our students who have some physical challenges, so we've got a couple of female athletes that are over 6 feet tall, their ability to manage the stresses of the game probably require a little bit more than that 2 hours per week we've allocated. So our fitness guys will set up something for them to be doing, either supervised by them or on their own. We have a number of students that come to us from outside of Austin, and they might come to us for 1 week a month, and then they have some stuff that they're doing at home. So our fitness guys would prescribe a program, and someone else would help apply that at their home base. We also have, we employ through Texas State University an athletic trainer. So we have an athletic trainer on staff every afternoon for practice for kids that have any kind of, you know, little, not full-blown injuries, but maybe they get a little sore, or maybe they came home from a tournament and they were really, they overused their elbow or their shoulder. And so the athletic trainer can work with them, and they don't miss practice, but they're doing something different other than just hitting tennis balls. So we have a pretty,
talk to us real quick about those kids who come in maybe a week at a time, because I think for our listeners, there will be a lot of people who are interested in something like that. So they come in, they spend a week, where are they staying? Yep. How are they booking it? How does that look?
So typically what happens is we get a lot of former Little Mo players, which you could probably understand. So kids come to the Austin Tennis Academy, they play the Little Mo Nationals, they like the facility, they like the coaches. They go home, and 2 or 3 years later, they're playing National 12s or National 14s, and maybe they become one of the best players in their area or their region, and their training needs to be beefed up a little bit. They want to have a little bit more challenge. So lots of times we get visits in the summer when there's no school to be contended with. We get lots of visits over spring break and over winter break. People who are visiting people in Austin. So typically the way that works is that they'll contact Deb Cahill, our operations director. She'll kind of suss out exactly what people are looking for. You know, do they want more fitness? Do they want more, you know, Coach Newman? Do they want more Coach Doug Davis? Do they want more matches? Do they want more training? You know, what is it that people are looking for? And then we can kind of tailor a program for each individual kid that comes. And typically they come with a parent and stay off-site. I have a young man that comes to me, has been coming to ATA since he was 8 years old, and his grandparents used to live not far from ATA. They live somewhere else now, but so when he comes in, he actually stays at my home when he's training here, and then goes back home and comes back and back and forth, and he'll travel with our team to tournaments, and I've taken him individually to a few tournaments as well. So that typical week, a month, or 2 or 3 weeks or 4 weeks over the summer, that sort of visitor gets a very kind of individualized program based on parent and home coach input of what they're looking for.
Yeah. And taking a step back, you know, when you said that, you know, when you had sort of the rainy days, you guys worked on, you know, physical and mental training. Talk a little bit about the mental training. What kind of, because I think that's always something that's tough to do in a group setting. And so what I'm trying to envision is, what does that look like for you guys?
Sure. So there's a number of skills that we would like each player at the Austin Tennis Academy to have. One of those skills is something that we call scripting. So it's just like a movie script, right? You're going to have all of the details written out in a script so that all of the actors know what they're supposed to do. Exit stage right, you know, drop to the floor, whatever. So we use this idea of scripting for players to write out strategy scripts. They can write out life scripts. They can basically work on a mental script of basically who they're trying to be, and wow, fill that in with as much detail as possible. So it's basically classroom work. That's real classroom work, right? Really trying to phrase everything in a positive way, use as much descriptive language as you can. Lots of kids decorate their scripts with pictures of their favorite players. So that's one skill, and that can be worked on. And most kids keep that as a kind of living document that grows over time. And inside of that script are some things that we call critical situations. So a player has a particular problem when someone questions their calls. They end up shutting down emotionally, and they lose because they get challenged on their honesty. and we can write out a script to say, how are you going to respond to that? What's the ideal response? How are you going to manage it? What are the step-by-step things you're going to say or do that allow you not to shut down in that situation? You could have another critical situation where you feel like the opponent's giving you bad calls, right? So how do you manage that? What are the step-by-step ways that you're going to handle that situation when it pops up in a tournament for you? So that idea of scripting is one very powerful mental tool that we'd like every player at ATA to have. That part of that tool is also something called a match card. So before every tournament, and sometimes before every match, players will write out a match card of mostly tactical or mental coaching. So a match card is, the way that we talk to our students about it is, a match card is basically, if I were sitting on the bench and on the changeover and you came and sat down, what would I say to you? What would I coach you to do? And, you know, some kids have some very particular strategic things on their match card for certain players. Other times players are very, you know, when things go well, they do the same things right every time. And so writing those things down, if I, you know, it could be as simple as, am I exhaling properly on every shot? Because that makes me more relaxed. So giving themselves, basically coaching themselves on the changeovers, that's another part of the scripting skill. So that's one skill that we'd like every player to have. Another set of skills are goal setting skills, understanding performance and outcome goals, understanding you know, how goals get broken down into smaller pieces, and helping our players have, you know, dreams. What is your dream goal? What are some of the stepping stone goals to that dream? And then what are the small goals, kind of daily goals that have to be accomplished for you to reach some of the stepping stone goals? So there's a whole process of goal setting that takes place as a skill. So those are two of the skills. Another skill is basically, you could call it meditation. We call it alpha, which is teaching players how to get into the alpha state. And the alpha state is a brain state where you are the most receptive to information, right? So just before you fall asleep or just before you wake up, that's usually the alpha state. It's a description of brainwave patterns, right? Alpha, delta, theta, all of that. So we try to teach players how to put themselves in the alpha state. So we do that by training them on a weekly basis on basically meditation techniques, right? How to contract and relax your muscles, how to visualize pictures, how to visualize techniques, how to visualize tactics. How to visualize mental situations is basically taking that script and running it inside your head in a very calming kind of situation. So that's always kind of in a laying down, totally body relaxed, eyes closed, controlling your breathing, and then running through these visualization patterns that we do. So that's another mental skill. So we've got scripting, including match cards. You've got goal setting. You've got the alpha technique. And part of that, the fourth skill is changeover skill. How do you use the changeover, and what is the process that you're going to use? And every player should have an eating plan and a thinking plan on the changeover, so that they're maximizing whatever they're going to be able to do there. So all of that combined with what we would call chalk talks. So a coach would take a video of the last French Open final. And if we're working on, you know, we've recently been working on how you make your opponent make mistakes. There was a recent great article about that. And they would go through the video looking for those ways that opponents made those mistakes, and pointing it out, and then rerunning it, and pointing it out, and rerunning it, and then looking for other examples of it. So those chalk talks are also rainy day mental training components. A final piece of that would be for example, private lessons that get rained out often are, we have a lot of videotape of players' matches. So you can purchase a videotape at a lot of national tournaments of matches, and we usually get a couple matches from every tournament and kind of archive them so that on a rainy day you can go back and you can go through your own personal match. I've got one student that comes to me. It's actually the son of a former student who comes to me, and he brings his GoPro. And every time he plays a practice match, he puts the GoPro up and he records the match and he reviews the match afterwards, sends notes about it, and sends it to his home coach and to me. So all of those, you know, it seems like there isn't that much to work on, but there's so much to work on. We don't have enough rainy days, really.
That's right. But, I mean, I love that answer. I'm glad we went over that, because I think that that's something that is missing in so many junior development programs, is that all those mental things you're talking about. And, you know, I wish that, you know, there's an opportunity for my son to do the things that you're talking about. So that's something we need to look into for sure.
Yeah. And I think one of the things is I record all of my child's matches and we watch them. And like you say, you're thinking, well, there's really nothing to work on. And then you watch the match and you can make a list of 10 bullet points of things in the first set. You're going, man, we really need to work on this, this, and this. So I would really encourage people, when you're sitting and watching the match, you can be very results oriented. Well, we're winning, you know, nothing to work on. But then when you watch it on video, it's very clear, like, whoa, you're not doing this well. You're not doing this well. And then those rainy days are a great time to talk about them, right? So I like that y'all reflect on those rainy days. And there's almost this feeling like there's more than we can, there's not enough rainy days for us to actually talk about it all, right? Because so many people on those rainy days waste that time.
Yep.
Yeah, we have a kind of philosophy at ATA that we don't cancel practice. If there's an ice storm or if there's a tornado, we've practiced. Cancel practice, but other than that, we're going to be there and we're going to do some work. And it may not be the most exciting work, you know, watching a video and trying to pull out the forced errors and all of that. It's maybe not the most exciting training, but there's some value in it for sure. And of course, the physical training, you know, physical toughness and mental toughness are intertwined. And so we like our players to be as physically tough as they possibly can be. Because we think it makes them mentally tough as well.
For sure.
Yeah, while we were there at Little Mo probably 3 years ago, it may have been you who did it, but literally while we were there, all the kids were there and they were on the court, and somebody rolled a chalkboard out on the court. I don't know if you remember this. They rolled like a rolling chalkboard, you know, like you would see in the 60s in a football locker room. And they described, they drew a tennis court on the chalkboard, and they described, like, you know, if you go cross court once and then you go cross court twice, the research showed that on the third time, the player didn't recover as well. And so that's when then we're going to change direction with our backhand because they're not going to recover as well. Was that you that did that?
I don't know if it was me that time, but that's a fairly common occurrence at ATA to have the rolling chalkboard out on court. So,
and I was, you know, I was real impressed because you could tell there wasn't just a sense of we're going to get out of here and we're going to hit forehands, we're going to hit backhands, we're going to hit serves, but it was really a teaching environment, right? We're going to teach you the mental skills of being a problem solver. Cause one of the things I noticed in tennis is that tennis pros and tennis coaches and tennis people in general overcoach the kids. And so when they walk on the court, they don't learn to be a problem solver because they've been told everything to do every single day. Right. And the only way you become a problem solver is to have the chance to screw up, fail, and think, and then learn for yourself. And what would I have done different? Right. And reflect. And so I love kind of the environment there that, we're always learning, we're always teaching, we're always growing. But at the same time, when you walk on the court, you got to figure it out for yourself, right? And I kind of sense that from y'all in your philosophy. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think a couple things. One, there's a lot of talk about failing forward, right? Every failure is a step forward. You may not recognize it, and you may not realize it, and you may not like it, but every failure is a movement forward. And I'd say the other is that we try to have our players play a full match at least once a week, and if we can, more than that, with not a lot of coaching supervision, some, but not micromanaging it, where they have to actually figure it out. And we do a lot of matches with different scenarios. So, for example, we do a lot of one-serve matches where players can only have one serve. We do a lot of starting at love 30 or starting 30 love. We're trying to work on finishing, or if we're trying to work on, you know, lengthening the match out. So giving players a kind of a general template of, okay, we hope you learn X, and we're going to set up the match situation with these parameters, and you play it and you work it, and then we'll talk about it afterwards.
Right. Yeah. Those situations are really good. And one of the things that we do is, instead of playing like a tiebreaker, you know, because sometimes when you do these groups or you get together, I'll just go play a tiebreaker. But, you know, to get to an important point, you've got to play about 14 points before it gets, you know, before the pressure gets there. So instead of that, we play like deuce games. So start every game at deuce, and, you know, then see who wins the set that way. It's about the same amount of time as a tiebreaker, but every point is, the pressure's a little bit more. So what you're talking about, you know, starting games at love 30 or 30 love, you're getting them in those situations that, you know, you talk about, but they're hard to replicate in practice unless you set them up that way. So I think those are really good.
Yeah. I'd say our favorite pressure situation is if you get a game point and you don't win it, you go to zero.
You're playing
a set, you're up 40 love, you don't win that point, you're down 15 love.
Oh, love it.
Yeah, that's good.
Lots of pressure.
Yeah. I bet there's some crying when they lose that point.
There's some long matches, let's put it that way.
Right. Well, and Robert, you brings up something I want to talk about also is, you know, we on our podcast, we had Ty Kwiatkowski on a couple of years ago, and he mentioned his coach at the time was Dewey Evans, who I know now is with you guys. So one of the things that was brought up was a situation where Ty was playing in a national hard court, and he got pulled off the court at a certain point in the match. And it's always an interesting debate about what's the right way to handle poor behavior, whether it's, you know, crime, whether it's, you know, banging your racket or abuse of, you know, equipment, things like that. So what or even cheating. So what is some of the things that are just, you know, non-starters for you guys in terms of, hey, our reputation at ATA is this, and we do not allow that. And so if that happens, you're off the court, or there's this repercussion. What are some of the things you guys talk about with those difficult situations?
Well, and before but one of the things I think that's important is the reason Scott's asking that question is it's kind of two-sided, right? I mean, you don't want to be so strict that you discourage competition, but you also don't want to be so lenient that you have somebody acting crazy on the court. So to add to Scott's question, how do you not kill the competitive nature of the kid while still encouraging them to behave?
Right. So I think it all starts with what's our goal, right? Our goal is to produce citizens of significance. That's our goal. And so we are, I would say, very strict. If you drop an F-bomb, you're out of practice. You can try again tomorrow. You throw your racket, you're out of practice. You could try again tomorrow. A lot of low level negativity. You see a lot of younger kids have a lot of low level negativity where they're kind of whining, crying, semi tanking. A bit of that will get you kicked out of practice and you can come back tomorrow. So we're pretty strict, and at tournaments, just as strict. I remember I had a boy who ended up playing for Penn State, who was, I think, in the quarterfinals of boys 12s hard courts and got pulled off the court because he was acting a fool. And that was a long car ride home from Arkansas after that. Pretty quiet.
Right.
And we've got a kid now who's playing at the University of Chicago, who's a semifinalist in doubles and quarterfinals in singles in the NCAAs. He got pulled out of our sectional championship twice and sent home because he wasn't acting well. So I think we're very strict. And so ATA has been in existence now, you know, for 16, 17 years. So the culture is pretty set. Players coming in, you know, get schooled by older players or by the behavior of older players. I would say, you know, we send somebody home from practice maybe once a year now, because we just don't have an issue with how players are going to behave. And I would say the other is, if we get a player who hasn't grown up in our program, who comes from somewhere else, and they're hot-headed and they're out of control, if they don't manage themselves well enough, we just ask them to leave and give them a refund and say, sorry, just not a good fit. So I think the length of time of the culture and a fairly successful program that allows us to fire a customer if they're not hitting the culture keeps our students in a fairly good framework during their practices and their competitions. So I think to kind of address the direct question of the idea of not squelching their competitive nature, my sense of it is, over the course of 30 years of doing this, that if someone is really, really competitive and you can show them the skills that are going to make them win more, they're going to fall right in line. You know, if I can show you lose an extra 10 points a match because of your attitude, and if you improved your attitude, you would not give up those 10 points and you might win 7 of them. How many matches turn on 7 points?
Yeah. Huge.
You could probably win a lot of matches with 7 points. If I could pick the 7 points to win.
Right.
So most people who are hyper competitive, part of it is being old enough to understand, right, to process the information they're getting.
That's right.
If you're 12, it's a different thing.
Right. And that's what I was going to ask is, so that way of thinking probably works for a 16-year-old. But now, and you've been at Little Mo, so now you're dealing with an 8-year-old who's hyper-competitive, or a 10-year-old, and I watch it so much, where you'll have an awesome player, and the player won't be misbehaving, in my opinion. They'll lose a point, and they'll cry. And the parent will just be beside themselves, or the fans will say stuff like, well, if that were my kid, right? And I'm thinking to myself, I love that kid, right? Like, that kid is competitive. They're just upset they lost a point, and they're 8, and they don't have the social awareness to not cry.
Maturity. Yeah.
And everybody's demonizing their behavior, and I'm thinking, man, I wish I could take that kid home with me, right?
Yeah. I don't mind crying. You know, I'll tell you a funny story. We had a young man, 7 or 8 years old, in our beginner program, started playing tennis. He played a lot of other sports too. His parents wanted him to learn the skills and learn the sport. And so he'd been in our group program for a number of months. And the parents called and said, hey, we'd like him to start taking some private lessons. Can you get someone, one of the coaches, to work with him? So we have a staff meeting once a week, and we're sitting around the table, and I said, okay, I got this phone call from this parent, and the parents want him to have privates who will coach him. And we go around the table, and no, 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 hell no, 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 all the way around the table. And I said, well, you know, what's the problem? Well, this kid cries at every practice. if he doesn't win the game he's playing, he cries at every practice. I don't want to have to babysit this guy. So I'm a little bit more experienced than these guys. And I say, okay, I'll take him. And he's a severe introvert, 8 years old, cries at every practice. So we have our first private lesson and we're sitting on the bench, right? So, you know, if you're two people normally sitting on the bench, your both knees are facing, you know, towards the court. Well, he faced perpendicular. So his body was facing 90 degrees away from me. So I couldn't.
Completely away from you.
Right. Completely. If he could have sat the opposite direction, he would have. So over the course of 2 to 3 years of private lessons, first of all, I never taught him anything. I just played a game. Okay, if you can do this, if you can hit the ball over my head and in, you win the point. If you can make the ball get down at my feet and bounce before me, you know, to put a lot of spin on the ball, you win the point. And if I get it back and you hit it past me, you get another point. It basically just made up a game for everything that I wanted him to do. So we kept going. He cried in our lessons, and I let him win pretty much every game that we ever played. He got better and better and better. So this guy ends up being a silver ball winner. He ends up playing for Vanderbilt University, ends up being one of the best players we ever had. Kid by the name of Jeffrey Offord. I'll probably embarrass him now because talking about him crying as an 8-year-old. The point that you made was a great one, that the crying to me is not an issue. If the kid is a competitive kid and they're 8 years old and they don't have control of their emotions, they're going to cry when they lose. That's no problem. You know,
no doubt.
I have a much bigger problem, you know, with kids throwing their racket or dropping the F-bomb or whatever.
Right,
so I think that's kind of how we manage that. And I'd say the other thing is for younger kids, we do a lot of timeouts, right? So if we're in a group practice and the kid's not managing it well for whatever reason, okay, you get to go and sit on the bench for 5 minutes, right? And if they want to do it, right, they want to compete, they want to play the game you're playing or whatever,
right?
So taking them out of the game is the biggest that you can give them. So you go sit down, and when you feel that you can manage playing, then you can come back. And it's got to be 5 minutes minimum. So by 3 minutes, they're squirming on the bench, you know, anxious to get back in. I say, well, do you think you can manage it now? Yes, coach, I can do it now. All right, you can come back in 3 minutes instead of five. So you give them a little cut in their bench time. So I think that sitting kids out is probably our number one, you know, younger kids who are not emotionally strong yet, just giving them a timeout for a few minutes to kind of gather themselves together usually is plenty.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things I like about what you said is first, you had the wisdom to understand this kid's not crying because they're hard to be around. They're crying because they want to win, right? And that's an important quality. And the rest of those coaches struggled to see that probably because they hadn't been around enough kids. As a coach myself in other sports, my first couple of years I took for granted a kid who enjoyed it and cared and competed and wanted to be there. And then you have enough kids that just want to be recreational. So when you see another kid that cares and is crying because they lose, as a veteran coach, you're going, dang, that's the kid I want to be around, right? The one that cares about it. And I think too many parents misunderstand that crying for something else, right? As a coach, I like the kid that is mad when they lose, that cries when they lose, that live and dies for every point, that's running for every ball. And I think what I love about what you said is you recognize that and you're like, you know what, I'll take the kid. And then the proof was in the pudding in the fact that he ended up being really good, goes play for Vandy. Because the bottom line, and I think you would agree with this and you tell me what you think, but when you're coaching kids, they got to want it more than you want it for them, right? And the ones who are competitive, they will kill themselves to be good. The ones who aren't competitive, they're only going to be as good as you make them or as you force them to be. And so it's a lot easier to coach those competitive ones. And I know when they're eight, they're crying. But But by the time they're 16, they're competing, and you just got to kind of mold them through that period. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think that you're absolutely right. I think coaches are only as good as the players that they get to coach. That's been my experience.
No doubt.
Yeah. So Jack, one of the things I'm always curious about is in a program like yours where you have a large variety of ages. You know, there's so much difference between an 8-year-old and a 12-year-old and a 12-year-old and a 14-year-old and a 14-year-old and an 18-year-old. How do you deal with the mix of your kids? You know, there was a really interesting video about the Chinese national swim team and how much the players or the kids mixed with older kids and younger kids, middle kids with ability versus kids with no ability versus girls and boys. So how do you deal with that in your academy? You know, because you got, you know, say 35, 40 kids, maybe more with the after school, all different ages, all different levels, different genders. What's your philosophy on mixing kids?
Sure. So in our academy program, the Texas competitive system is a 3-level system, challenger, champ, and super champ. In order to be in our academy program, you have to be a champ level player. So the bottom level in our academy program is a fairly high threshold. So, but there is a difference between a 12-year-old champ and a 18-year-old national level player for sure.
Right.
As far as boys and girls, zero kind of, we sometimes have a girls practice where it's only girls. Mm-hmm. But on a daily basis, our kind of go-to, court division is by UTR. So, your position to start out with in our program is based on your UTR. Your position moving forward is based on your performance. So we mm-hmm. do something called MVPs every day, most valuable players every day on a set of courts, either a set of 2 or a set of 3 courts. If you're the mm-hmm. MVP of your set of courts, the next day's practice, you're probably going to be more challenged, right? So I don't pay a lot of attention to age. I don't pay a lot of attention to boy or girl. Level of accomplishment is kind of the way that we organize practice. So kids understand that and accept it. And, you know, I think UTR is, there's a lot of pluses and minuses about UTR, but I think most people accept it as a kind of good year-long metric, right? If you look at it once or twice a year, you're probably doing pretty good. If you're checking it every day, it's probably not as good.
Yeah, and let me ask you an equipment-related question. So how do you deal with your – and I'm asking this just from personal reasons. How do you deal with your younger kids who are – you know, say you got a 10, 11-year-old who's a 7 UTR, and what strings and what racket would you recommend? I mean, like for my personal child, he's only 75 pounds, you know, he's in a higher UTR range, but he's on a light racket, like a 270-gram racket with synthetic gut-type string. And every time I take him to a little bit heavier of a racket, there's an injury, so we bring him back down, and there's not an injury. How do you kind of manage that equipment with parents? Because, you know, if you got an 11-year-old who's 110 pounds, that's a lot different from an 11-year-old who's 75 pounds.
Sure. Let me preface this with, I am the last person in the planet Earth that you want to be asking about rackets and strings. I am a very laissez-faire coach on that. In my philosophy is, it's not the equipment. It's the operator that usually is the difference. There are some players and some coaches and some parents who are racket and string aficionados. I am not one of those. We have a top, whatever the top certification is for racket stringing, we have a guy who has that, and I lean on him for recommendations. So, for example, the kid that I was telling you about that comes to me from Colorado, he's getting ready to switch. He's gone from, he's 14, turned 15, he's playing 1600 nationals. He's gotten a lot bigger and stronger in the last 3 to 4 months. So he's been using a lighter racket, and we're thinking about putting a heavier racket with a little bit denser string pattern in his hand. So we're going to give him three or four different demos to practice with and see what he likes. And I'm kind of a, like I said, I'm very laissez-faire. I let the players decide what they like and then support whatever they like. I think that, you know, obviously there are, you know, silly things like the weight of the racket. You know, if you weigh 75 pounds and you're trying to use a racket that, you know, Karlovich uses, that's probably not the right racket for you.
right.
But other than those kind of crazy choices, I'm a big believer in letting players try and pick their own rackets and then use the experts who know all about rackets and strings, which it's not an area that I am that interested in. And like I said, I'm very laissez-faire about it. So sorry, I couldn't be more helpful.
Well, I'm sure you see it, though. I'm sure you see, like, what I've noticed is the kids who are, you know, in puberty or post-puberty, the competition is not a problem. But those kids who are 10, 11 that you see at Little Mo, they, in order for them to get even a good competitive match, they're having to play kids that are 16, 17 years old, you know, right, or even older. And it can be difficult because now they're getting, even though they can manage the ball and they can play the match and they can compete in the match and they may even win it, I don't know how the aggressiveness, the physicality of the match is probably not a healthy thing for a 10-year-old, even though they can compete.
I think you're right. And I think we're lucky in the respect of having a big program. So the difference between players in any kind of grouping is not that great. So, you know, a good 10-year-old at ATA won't have to play an 18-year-old to get a good competitive match, right? I've probably got a 13-year-old can, you know, give them as much of competition as they really want. So for us, having that larger number of people in the pool probably gives us a few more practice partners, a few more match partners that aren't so physically overwhelming.
And one other question there, you know, we talk about stringing. How important do you think it is for junior players to string their own, learn how to string rackets and be that much more familiar with their equipment? Or is that something you don't really care that much about?
I think a couple things about that. One, I think any player that has to string their own rackets has a greater appreciation for what they have. So that's first thing I would say. The second thing I would say is there are only a certain number of hours in the day. And if I want a student to study for the SAT and I want them to do their physical training and I want them to do their on-court training and I want them to do their mental training, if I'm short on time, probably stringing the racket would be one of the things I would cut out of that. And I'm not in any way saying there isn't value in it. There's certainly value in it. And I think that probably as a player reaches a higher level of accomplishment, the amount of time they have to spend on other things probably becomes greater. And relying on experts who can do it really well and quickly and efficiently probably is what I would recommend. But especially for kids that are younger, learning how to string their own racket. Again, it's like anything, right? If you had to pay for your own lessons by mowing lawns, you would be able to equate, okay, X number of lawns equals one lesson. So now I have an appreciation for what the value of that is, right? So I think any way that we can help our students understand the value of what they're getting is a good thing. I had this actually interesting conversation that we're having this about tonight is that two or three weeks ago I was with a player and we were talking about, do you recognize the cost of what it means for you to be excellent? And they had absolutely no clue. And so we started walking through, what does it cost to take a plane ride to Boston? What does it cost to buy meals for a week on the road? What does it cost to rent a car? What does it cost for a hotel room? And then how many, you know, whatevers If your dad's a doctor, how many patients does he have to see? If your dad's a dentist, how many patients does he have to see? If your dad's a lawyer, how many clients does he have to see? If your dad washes dogs for a living, how many dogs does he have to wash so that you can go to that term? So
right.
getting the player to have a greater appreciation for what they were getting, right? That to me is part of my job too, is to help that player grow as a human being. And so, certainly stringing your own rackets, the kids who've strung their own rackets at ATA, they have a greater appreciation for it, right? They have a greater appreciation for the racket. They have a greater appreciation for the strings and the cost there.
Well, and I think what I like about what you're saying is you're not shaming the child into trying hard. All you're doing is saying, you know, your parent is given 110% and all they're asking is that you do the same.
Yeah, that was really the whole gist of the conversation was, and it wasn't that the kid wasn't trying hard enough. They were doing great. It was just, it was really kind of a precursor to, you know, the kid's at the national level and he's ready to make a breakthrough from being, you know, a top 50 player to be a top 10 player. There's a certain level of commitment that is higher. When you start, you know, the higher you go, the higher your commitment level goes. And so what I was trying to get him to think about was his own commitment level, right? And helping him understand what his parents' level was. Are you on par? Are you commensurate with their commitment level? And are your goals, you know, what are your goals? And because, you know, 15, 16, they're not following the coach's goals anymore. They're not following the parents' goals anymore. They're following their own dreams. They're following their own goals. And if they are not passionate about it, then all of that expenditure to me is a waste. If they're passionate about it, then all of that expenditure is really, and it was interesting, that same conversation, we started talking about the value of that and what the numbers actually added up to. I said, well, what do you think your parents would pay for you to be in drug rehab? Right, because he had had a neighbor kid who had to go to drug rehab, and he said, "Oh, my parents would pay any amount of money so I wouldn't be on drugs." I said, "Right. So if their investment in tennis is X number of thousands of dollars a year, and being in drug rehab is 3X, they might think you being in tennis is a good value, right? Because you're in a healthy environment and you're in health." So that was another way to help him kind of understand the whole, where he's at in this whole process. So it was a very interesting conversation.
It is. So tell us this, is if a parent wants to come to ATA for a week, or if they just want to get to know you, or if they want to contact you, tell us some of the ways they can get in touch with you.
Yeah, I'm really hard to get in touch with because I'm on the court quite a bit and I'm traveling quite a bit. But Deb Cahill, DEBCAHILL, is our operations director, and she manages people who come to visit. She sets up the times, the dates, does the research on what people are looking for, and she's our best contact. And her email address is deb.cahill@austintennisacademy.com, and her cell phone number is 512-680-8057. So people who would like to come to ATA to try a week for summer camp or spring break or winter break camp can call her or email her, and she can get them the details of all of that. There's a bunch of information on our website, you know, www.austintennisacademy.com, about everything that we talked about tonight. If people want to research it, they get online, and there's tons of information there as well.
Yeah, and what about an awesome facility? I mean, real quick, Scott, it's an awesome facility, and one of the first things, I brought my son Everett when he was 8 to play at Little Mo, and I'll never forget him running to me. I was late to get on the courts, and you know, at Little Mo, y'all have like the clinic environment the day before the tournament, and he ran up. He's like, "Dad, they got red clay," you know, so the facility is top-notch for any environment that you're looking for. What were you going to say, Scott?
No, I was just going to ask if they had social media accounts that people could follow to see what the latest and the greatest is.
Oh, we've got amazing social media.
All right.
We've got Twitter. We've got you name it, we've got it.
Fantastic.
We are everywhere.
All right.
And so we just need to just go to the website, Austin Tennis Academy, and we can find all your social media from there?
Yeah, you can click on, we've got a Twitter widget where you can see everything that's on our Twitter feed on our website. All of our Facebook, all of our, you name it, we're doing something on it.
Well, Jack, we appreciate your time so much. We learned a lot about your academy, and I think we learned a lot of things that are going to help us also, especially with the mental part. That I think that was really interesting. And so, you know, I appreciate your time and giving us, just being so open and forthcoming with us for what you guys do there. Sounds like it's a really good program, and I wish that there was more Austin Tennis Academies around the country.
For sure.
Well, thanks for having me on, and I enjoyed it, and anytime that I can be of service, let me know.